You all have your test papers back from the last test, which I gave you last week. And today or tomorrow, I'd be glad to look at the paper with anybody that has any questions about it. I'll be available today between 11 and 11:30 and between 1:30 and 4. And we can arrange time tomorrow if that would suit some of you better than today. If you have any question about the test, see my secretary and she will make a precise time for me to see you, because I'd be glad to look at the paper with anybody that has any questions. Yes?
Dr. McGregor, you also received
a brief
papers back. Getting
the which? Yes, at the beginning of the next semester, give me a note asking for it, and I'll be glad to get back. I like to keep the free papers that were turned in, because very often when it's difficult to decide between, say, a mark of 80 and a mark of 85, I read them over again and compare them with the three tests and the exam. I like to have all the material together to make that decision. But anyone who wants the paper back, who hasn't kept a carbon copy of it and would like to have it back, at the beginning of the new semester, leave a note for me, or any time in the first month of the new semester, and I'll be glad to get it to you. Now, in the test, you've probably noticed, sometimes I ask questions which are identical with one of the points that we have taken. And in that case, I'm interested to know that you know what I thought was important in that connection and what I gave in that connection. But many of the questions that I asked are not directly related to the outline. Like I asked in this last test from one half of the class to discuss the theories of the date of Daniel. Now, of course, there's much that can be said about Daniel that we haven't touched on in this class at all. But in this class, we touched on, we mentioned two theories as to the date of Daniel. The question whether the date of Daniel was the time of Nebuchadnezzar and just afterwards, when the events described and took place, or as most of the critics say, the time about 160 B.C., the time of the Maccabean revolt. Those are the two possible times, that is the two times that are held for the book of Daniel. There might be some who advance other theories, but the most Bible-believing students believe that it was written by Daniel at the time of Nebuchadnezzar or shortly after. Most critics believe that it was written this later period. But in the course of the year, while this is not a course in Daniel, we have discussed in connection with other matters things that related very definitely to these two dates. And there were two main things we discussed. One of them was the matter of the critical theory of the canon, because one of the big arguments given for the late date of Daniel is that at the time when Daniel was written, the canon of the prophets was closed, and therefore it could not yet have been written then. And so the fact it didn't get into the canon of the prophets proves it wasn't written till the late date. I read your quotations from 6 or 8 different critical books, commentaries on Daniel, presenting that argument. And that was a part of my introduction to a rather lengthy discussion of the critical theory of the canon. So that, of course, was the most important thing in relation to the book of Daniel we've had this semester. But then there was the other matter, which I devoted a good part of a day to, the fact that at first sight, in relation to archaeological discoveries, it appeared that what the Bible said about Belshazzar did not correspond to actual fact. And then that recently there have been discovered, that is during the present century, evidences that Belshazzar existed, evidences that Belshazzar was co-ruler with his father in the kingdom, evidences that Belshazzar was killed when the city was taken, and these three fit with what is said in the book of Daniel. That we've only dealt with on one day, but I devoted a large part of one lecture to it. So as you see, this drew material from various areas which had dealt with that one subject. I merely mentioned these as illustrations. Now, in the test, if you only gave one of these two, naturally you could only get half credit for that particular question. But that is the sort of questions that I like to give in examinations, one of these two main types. We will not meet this Thursday. We have just the two more lectures today and tomorrow. And I'd like to mention this, that this course is mainly a course of giving you factual material, which is important and helpful in the study of the Old Testament. We devoted perhaps a fourth of the course, maybe a little more, this semester to discussing the critical theory of the canon. But at least two-thirds of the course was factual material of interest and value for understanding the Old Testament. The greater part of our three-year course is material of that type. Factual material or methods of Bible study that are helpful in learning what is God's will for us and how to present it. But during the last century and a half, there has been a great movement among people who occupied positions either supported by a government or by a large endowment, which gave them a good living to devote themselves to studying and teaching the Bible, who have devoted their energies to tearing down faith in the Bible instead of building it up. And the result is that there are a great number of highly trained scholars in Great Britain and in France and in Germany and in the United States who during this last century and a half have been working out theories to account for the existence of the Bible on a viewpoint that assumes that what it actually teaches is false. That God did not act in human affairs, but this has all come about as a result of natural humanistic development. And we spent perhaps a month this year discussing those theories that they have advanced regarding the canon. Now, during our course, our three-year course, we do not spend a great deal of time on these theories. But these theories have destroyed the faith of multitudes of young people who have been intending to devote their lives to the Lord's service. They have been one of the most effective instruments Satan ever developed to lead people away from making their lives count for Christ. And so it is necessary that we get a good, solid understanding of some of the features of these theories. To fully understand them, we take the whole 3 years on it. And we don't feel that would be right. But to get a good, thorough understanding of their basic foundation, attitudes, and viewpoints, we feel is very important. But this is quite involved often and very technical. That's one thing that gives these theories, makes it easy for them to have the influence they are, that young men go into one of our old established theological seminaries, and a man with many degrees presents the explanation of what the Bible really teaches, and it's all they can do to get the notes down and get a quick idea of what he says the facts are. And they come out with little doubt that these are true, though you will find very few of them that have any very real understanding of the theories or of the arguments on which they are based. But the professors who teach the theories are constantly writing books and articles, not so much defending them now as presenting them and showing their implications in relation to the Bible. And they are becoming constantly a greater force in American religious life. They are held by most of the leaders of most of our large denominations. And the two or three large denominations that up until fairly recently resisted them, today are receiving into their leadership people who are thoroughly accepted. So in our 3-year course, it is necessary that we take a certain amount of time to get the foundation understanding of these theories. And the major course in that direction is the course that I will give next semester, the course in Introduction to the Pentateuch. It will be devoted 9/10 of it to the study of these critical theories. And I feel that anyone who has had the most of his seminary course is in a far better position to get the value out of that course than one who is just starting. And therefore, while my church history course that I give for 2 years running, I like to have all new students take. There's no preliminary training necessary for them, and they are, I think it's good to take them soon and get them out of the way. This one course in Pentateuch next semester, if a person is going to be here 3 years from now, I think it's far better he take it then than take it now. In fact, I believe I'm going to insist on first semester Hebrew completed as a prerequisite to taking it, because anyone who hasn't completed the first semester of Hebrew certainly cannot finish in 3 years. So all my other courses, including the one we just had, I'm glad to have beginning students take. But next semester, unless you definitely are going to finish in 3 years, I would much prefer that you take it in the fourth year, 3 years from now, rather than now. Because there's a great deal of material to cover, and I like to go fairly rapidly in it to get as much as possible in the time we have. We don't spend much time on these critical theories, but I do think a solid understanding of the introduction to the Pentateuch is very useful for a Christian minister who is going to come in contact with students who've taken a course in religion in almost any college today of any age, in almost any theological seminary of any age. He's going to find their minds filled with these theories, whether they realize it or not. And the ability to point to their real weaknesses can be of great value in meeting not a great many people, but the people who have great leadership potential and who are going to be important in days to come in leading the Lord's people, either for or against the truth. But now we are continuing with this discussion. I believe we're in number 8, the versions of the Old Testament, and I believe it was number C, the Greek version. And under that, we were discussing number 1, the Septuagint. And we mentioned that the Greek version, which, yes?
You mentioned just a few minutes ago about there were foundations to and governments.
Yeah.
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 I've never heard that before. Could you just...
Yes. Yes. In Germany, the great universities are all government-controlled and tax-supported. And these universities in Germany were established, most of them, in the days shortly after the Reformation, when people were keenly interested in the Bible and anxious to train young people to be able to present the Word of God truly to their people. And so they established in most of the German universities, they have what they call different faculties. And first is always the faculty of theology. And then there's the faculty of philosophy, which covers most of what we call humanistic studies here. And then there may be medicine, law, the others may vary in different universities. But these officials are recommended by the members of the faculty, but appointed and the final selection made by the government in Germany. And the result is that when you got into these positions, men who had turned away from belief in the Bible, these men trained others in unbelief and recommended them to be their successors and assistants. So that for the last century and a half, most of these positions in Germany, supported by the state through taxation, have been men who were duty was to devote themselves to study of the Bible, but whose belief was antagonistic to Christian attitudes toward the Bible. And of course that meant that these men didn't have to spend time making a living some other way. They could spend all their time studying the Bible, but studying it from a destructive viewpoint. Now that's been true in Germany. Now in England and in Scotland you have a somewhat similar situation. The salary there does not come from the government, but it comes from large endowments which are possessed by the university, in which chairs of Bible were established years ago when almost everyone believed thoroughly that the Bible was true. And great sums of money were given to endow these chairs. And these men hold these chairs. They are paid to devote their lives to the study of the Bible, but they're perfectly free to spend the time tearing it down instead of building it up. In this country, that is true some extent also. For instance, I know of a woman's college which was founded by earnest Christian people who were anxious to train young women to be fine Christian women in America, and all students are required to take a number of courses in Bible. It is one of the best-known, most highly regarded women's colleges in the United States, but it is right in the original charter of it. All students have to take these courses in Bible. And I have known very fine Christian young women who've gone to that college and been required to take these courses in Bible, which are taught by men who thoroughly believe the higher critical theory. and deny all the fundamental Christian doctrines, and most of these young women have either completely lost their faith or at least have lost their interest in any spreading of Christian teaching. And there are, so the situation in the United States in that regard is somewhat different from these other countries, but yet related to it. There was a wealthy woman in New York who gave money to a southern college for a department of Bible, desiring that people, this is about 40 years ago, desiring that people be trained to believe the Bible and to present its teachings. And then she found out that the teaching being given in the department was tearing the Bible down and teaching the higher Christians. And she went down there and complained, and they said, we have academic freedom here. These teachers of Bible teach what they believe to be true. We do not interfere with it. Well, she said, I don't want my money to go for that purpose. Well, they said, you gave your money to the college. It's ours now. You gave it for study of Bible. We're using it for that. She was very much upset about it. And finally, they very graciously agreed that the money she had been given might be transferred to the Department of Mathematics instead of Bible in that particular case. But in many other cases, people have given money to establish chairs for the advancement of Christianity, and the people who are receiving the income from that are tearing it to pieces instead of developing it. Well, the Septuagint, we mentioned, is the is if you buy a Greek version of the Old Testament, that is an ancient Greek, what you receive will probably be what we call the Septuagint. But as we mentioned, actually the name Septuagint only properly applies to the first five books. But the rest of it was translated at different times by different people, some very good translations, some very poor translations. But all of it, quite an early translation of the Old Testament into Greek, and therefore all of it of great interest and value. I mentioned something of the value of the Septuagint for textual purposes, and also, of course, it's of great value for suggesting meanings of words, to show what the people thought the words meant at that time. But I gave you certain very important cautions on the use of all versions, which particularly apply to the Septuagint. I named four specific cautions in that connection. Now, this was number one under the Greek versions, the Septuagint. Now I want to make number two, materials for Septuagint study. Now if you want to study the Septuagint, of course the most valuable thing is an ancient copy of the Septuagint, but you can hardly get one of those. But if you go to the British Museum, you can there see Manuscript B, called Manuscript A, Alexandrinus is called, and Manuscript Aleph, Sinaiticus, two of our oldest New Testament manuscripts, and each of them also includes many large sections of the Old Testament, made in about the 4th century A.D. This we call ancient copies of the Septuagint. Also, if you go to Rome and have proper credentials, in the Vatican Library, you can see the manuscript B, with the manuscript Vaticanus, which is of great importance in New Testament textual study, but which also has the greater part of the Old Testament in it, and that we call the Septuagint. Now, these three ancient manuscripts, then, are our best source for knowledge of the readings of the Septuagint. From these, other copies were made, copies and recopies and recopies through the years, and eventually, at the time of the Reformation, when people began printing copies of the Bible, they took the manuscripts available to them and made a conflate presentation of the Septuagint from late manuscripts, just as was done with the New Testament, and these we called the Textus Receptus. If you had a question, let's see.
I
wouldn't want to go into these much here because in New Testament introduction they're gone into quite at length for New Testament. But the three most important manuscripts for New Testament are also for Old Testament. And they are A, which we call Alexandrinus, B, which we call Vaticanus, and Aleph, We use the Hebrew letter for that one. Sometimes they use the letter S instead. And that we call Sinaiticus because it was found in the Sinai Peninsula. And those are the three oldest manuscripts available of the greater part of the New Testament and also of the Old. Yes, sir?
Yes.
The Textus Receptus is the publication made 400 years ago of the New Testament or the Old Testament, which at that time received widest recognition. That is, there were 400 years ago various copies of New Testament and Old Testament printed. But nobody had any large number of manuscripts available, and no one of these three manuscripts was available. And of those various copies that were printed, there was one in each case which received general acceptance and which was copied and recopied until within the last 60 years and consequently came to be called the Textus Receptus. In the New Testament, the Textus Receptus is almost exactly the version that Erasmus got up. And Erasmus, one of Luther's great adversaries, I never had reason to think he was inspired. But there are a number of books which have appeared recently trying to prove the Textus Receptus is the original Greek New Testament. Well, God could have caused it to be that way, but there's no evidence he did. And I believe we're much wiser to go back to old manuscripts and study them. I don't mean that the theory that any particular scholar gives you as to which of them is correct is necessarily right. But I think the older manuscripts deserve recognition ahead of the version that Erasmus got out. As a matter of fact, the Textus Receptus of the New Testament contains six verses which are not in any Greek manuscript anywhere. They were simply written by Erasmus. He didn't make them out of his head. He made a translation from the Greek, from the Latin Vulgate, because he had no manuscript that contained the last six verses of Revelation. And those were printed over and over until recent years as part of the Textus Receptus of the New Testament. That's not done anymore because we go back of Erasmus, back to the early manuscript. Now, in the Old Testament, the ordinary copy of the Septuagint you would buy would just be the Textus Receptus. And since the Septuagint was not preserved anywhere nearly as well as the Hebrew Old Testament was, or as the Greek New Testament was, a copy of the Textus Receptus of the Septuagint is not going to be anywhere near as near to the original as a copy of the Textus Receptus of the Hebrew Old Testament or the Greek New Testament would be. But an English professor named Sweet, S-W-E-T-E, Professor Sweet, about 60 years ago, got out in, I believe it was four volumes, three or four, I forget, an edition of the Septuagint in which he took manuscript B and simply printed that. And he printed manuscript B except for those sections where manuscript B had pages torn out or missing. And in those cases, he took manuscript A or S if it were available for him, and if not, the other old, whatever oldest he could find. And in each case, he puts in the margin a statement showing what manuscript he's copying from. So if you want to do careful study of the Septuagint, Sweet's edition in three or four volumes is by far the most convenient and dependable, most dependable, convenient edition of the Septuagint. Now, there at Cambridge, subsequent to that time, there's been put out what they call the Cambridge Septuagint in large pages, folio volumes, comparatively little in each volume, usually one book for a book of the Old Testament, in which they try to give you the readings of a great many Old Testament Greek manuscripts. And the Cambridge Septuagint, for careful, close study of the Septuagint, is of great value. For the ordinary student, Sweet will give you sufficient for your purpose. And, of course, if you don't have Sweet, anybody that knows Greek can find real value in just an ordinary copy of the Septuagint. To read it, it may suggest ideas to your mind as to translation. But you want to check them with the Hebrew. which has been preserved far better than the Septuagint. Yes, sir? I don't know. I'm not in touch with that particular feature at present. I know that 40 years ago there were many copies of it all around. But how it is now, I don't know. But it's strange if somebody doesn't get out in one volume the text of Sweet. It wouldn't be too hard to do. But I haven't kept in touch with that. So. Yes, Mr. Dr. Silver? No, just the Old Testament. Sweet is just the Old Testament. Yeah. Well, now, for materials then, for Septuagint study, as I say, if you wanted to do extremely careful work in the Septuagint, you would want to be near a library where they would have Holmes Parsons, which is a list of the readings of hundreds of manuscripts. It's very difficult to find, made about 200 years ago, and collation of the reading of the text. For most people, very few would need something as exhaustive as that. If you want to do very thorough work, but not quite that thorough, the Cambridge Septuagint, which I don't think is yet complete, but covers most of the Old Testament, gives you readings of many manuscripts put in the footnotes of the text, but in many volumes. And for a person doing somewhat less exhaustive work than that, I would say Sweet was very excellent and valuable to have, but I would say that anybody who knows Greek, a copy of any version of Septuagint, any edition of Septuagint, would be of some value. Yes, Mr. Eisen?
Would you spell that Holmes?
Yes, Holmes, H-O-L-M-E-S, dash, Parsons, P-A-R-S-O-N-S. Those are the two men in England who made this collation, this statement of the readings of various Septuagint manuscripts. Now these are then the main materials for Septuagint study. One other, which I should mention, which we'll take up more fully under the next head, is what we call sub-version. That is translations made from the Septuagint. So we'll look at that as number three, sub-version. That is to say, in ancient times, in the early days of the Christian era, when Christians read the Septuagint, it was their Bible. It was the Old Testament popularly read by the great mass of Jews, too, for some centuries. But then when Christians began to argue on the basis of the Septuagint, the Jews turned away from it. And one Jewish writer said in the Talmud that the two worst days in the history of Israel were the day when they made the golden calf and the day when the Septuagint was translated. In other words, they turned violently against the Septuagint as Christians argued from the Septuagint. And so all our copies of the Septuagint since maybe 300 AD have been preserved through Christian hands, not through the Jews. We have no ancient copies except a few portions found among the Dead Sea Scrolls that were made by Jews. But the Jews made the original translation, which Christians have copied and recopied through the centuries. But the Septuagint, in those days when Christians began to argue from the Septuagint, Christians in countries where they didn't know Greek well naturally wanted to translate it into their own language. And so in various countries they made translations from the Septuagint, just as some missionaries today will make translations into a missionary language from English instead of from the original Greek or Hebrew. Similarly, they made translations of the Old Testament from the Septuagint, people who didn't even know the original Hebrew. And so we have the Old Latin. Now, there's not a great deal of the Old Latin preserved, but there is some. The Old Latin is the translation made into Latin before the days of Jerome. Jerome's translation was so much better that the Old Latin disappeared. But the Old Latin was made from the Septuagint. And so you wouldn't trust the Old Latin translation to tell you what the Hebrew is because it's gone through two hands, you might say. And there's double chance of it being not exact. But to find out what the Septuagint said at that time, the Old Latin can be of great value. And there's a translation into Ethiopic. Into Ethiopic made from the Septuagint, which agrees marvelously closely with manuscript B. and which therefore is given great attention by many scholars in the attempt to determine the original text of the Septuagint. So there are many translations in ancient times from the Septuagint into other languages, of which a few have been preserved. Now these are ancient translations. They are not immediate translations of the Old Testament. They are immediate because they are through the Septuagint. Now number four, the importance of the Septuagint for New Testament study. The importance of the Septuagint for New Testament study. There are 3 points we will mention. Number 1, vocabulary. The New Testament discusses subjects in Greek language, many of which subjects we do not find touched on in any other ancient Greek writing. Of course, we have writings by Christians based on the New Testament, but Greek pagan writings naturally don't discuss Christian doctrine. And so if you want to know what a word in the New Testament meant at the time when it was written, the best way to find out is to see how it's used in the rest of the New Testament. But when you have a word used only 2 or 3 times in the New Testament, you need other help. And the New Testament writers often quote the Septuagint. They were all familiar with the Septuagint. And consequently, the way a New Testament word is used in the Septuagint is often of great value in determining its precise meaning. So for study of New Testament vocabulary, the Septuagint is of great value. That's number 1, then, vocabulary. Then number 2, under 4, so we call them A and B, A, B, and C. A, vocabulary. B, it is a bridge. B would naturally stand for bridge, wouldn't it? It is a bridge between the two Testaments. The Septuagint is a bridge between the New Testament. The New Testament quotes from the Old Testament and very often uses the Septuagint. The words, then, of the Hebrew Old Testament were translated by Jews into Greek in the Septuagint. And these words are used by New Testament writers. And the subject matter of the New Testament has a great relation to the subject matter of the Old Testament. And so the Septuagint constitutes a bridge between the two Testaments, and therefore is of great value for New Testament study. Now a third reason is that the Septuagint, small c, the Septuagint is often quoted in the New Testament. It is often quoted in the New Testament, but not always by any means. A problem that many people run into, even people who do not know Hebrew or Greek at all, often run into this problem. That the New Testament will say, as was stated in the Old Testament someplace, and then they'll give you something which you don't find in your Old Testament. And of course the reason is that often it is quoting from the Septuagint. And some people find a real problem about verbal inspiration there. But it shouldn't be a real problem in that regard, because we should remember that you cannot make an exact translation of anything into any language. From one language into another, there is always a loss of a certain amount of the material, of the idea. You cannot translate exactly. You may understand exactly what it means, but you can't necessarily put it into words in the other language. And the result of that is that there would be no point in God attempting to give us a verbally exact translation of the Hebrew into the Greek, because the way he's made languages, there can't be an exact translation of anything from one language into another. And very often, you take something in Hebrew or in Greek, and you can make a good translation of it into English, which gives 3/4 of the meaning in the original. And the other 1/4 of the meaning in the original, you can't get into a translation in the English. Unless you put that in your translation and lose the 3/4 that's already in the other translation. So the translation that gives you 3/4 of the meaning of the original is by far the better translation, but yet the other 1/4 of the meaning is part of the meaning of the original. And so if the New Testament is building on an idea contained in something in the Old Testament, but not brought out in the Septuagint translation, they will give you, the writer will give you his own translation of it. And so we often have the Septuagint not followed, but a direct translation from the Hebrew, which may not be as good a translation as the translation of the Septuagint, but which is a correct translation in that it truly brings out an idea that is truly in the original. So don't say, this is exactly what the Old Testament means, because this is the way the inspired New Testament translates. There's no such thing as an exact translation. But say the idea contained in the original, which is brought out in this translation, is really there, because the New Testament translates it in such a way to bring it up. And that works the other way around, too, you see. Because the Septuagint translation may not be a particularly good translation in certain places. But it may bring out clearly the particular idea that is in the original that the New Testament writer wants to bring out. And if that's the case, he'll just quote the Septuagint. And that doesn't mean everything in his translation, in the Septuagint translation, is correct at all. But it means that this idea, which is important in the New Testament context, which is in the Septuagint translation, is really in the original Hebrew. So you see that problem, which to some people is a terrible problem. If the Old Testament and New Testament are both verbally translated, how can the New Testament quote the Old Testament as saying something that we don't find in the Old Testament? That's a real problem for people knowing only English and studying. But once you realize that they're in two different languages and realize the difficulty of translation, the impossibility of exact translation from one language to another, you see that actually it's not a problem in relation to verbal inspiration at all. Inspiration does not mean that everything you could possibly squeeze out of that verse is correct. It means that the verse gives the ideas God wants it to give and that it is properly interpreted, free from error of fact, of knowledge, or a fact of doctrine, or of judgment. Well, now, then, it is often quoted in the New Testament, and time and again, studying a New Testament passage, it is very important to go back to the Old Testament passage, of course. And here's another thing that is important to remember, and that is, in the New Testament, very often you'll find he gives a certain thought in the New Testament, and then he says, this we find in the prophets, and he quotes two words, and then he goes on. And you read those two or three words, and you say, how on earth does that prove what the New Testament writer said? And the fact is that those two or three words don't prove it. He is referring you to an Old Testament context that proves it. And he may use a few words to remind you of that Old Testament passage. And when you look at the Old Testament passage, in its context, you will find that it proves what the New Testament says is proven from. So those are very important cautions in using the New Testament quotations, but also important thoughts in truly understanding what it means. Now that was number four, important for New Testament study. Number five is other Greek versions. I mentioned that the Jews turned strongly against the Septuagint. But there were many Jews living in areas where Greek was the spoken language. And these Jews, some of whom were previous Christians who had either reverted to Judaism or turned to Judaism, began to see that they needed a translation they could depend upon that didn't have Christian ideas in it, like the translation that had been made by Jews two or three centuries earlier. So they began to make new translations into Greek. There are three of these of particular importance. They go by the names of Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodosius. If you want to write those down, Aquila, A-Q-U-I-L-A. A-Q-U-I-L-A. Symmachus, S-Y-M-M-A-C-H-U-S. Symmachus, S-Y-M-M-A-C-H-U-S. And Theodosius, capital T-H-E-O-D-O-T-I-O-N. T-H-E-O-D-O-T-I-O-N. Now these three, Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodosius, in the first and second centuries A.D., made new translations into Greek of the Old Testament. And these translations have been lost, but portions of them have been preserved. And we know that Aquila's translation was extremely literal. Very, very literal. Like he says, in the beginning God created the heaven and the earth. He says, in the beginning God created with the heaven and with the earth. Because he had to have something to represent the Hebrew S. and he put in soon with, which doesn't make any sense, but which is very useful to know exactly what was in the Greek that he was translating. So Aquila is very, very literal. Symmachus is more flowing Greek style, quite a bit freer. And Theodotion is somewhat different, from maybe halfway between these two. And Theodotion is apt to be quoted in the Gospel of John. And in fact, in our ordinary copies of the Septuagint, it's Theodotion's text rather than the Septuagint text that we have. The Septuagint text of Daniel, if you want, you have to get it separately, because our copies usually include Theodotion's Daniel for some reason instead of the Septuagint one. Well, at about 250 A.D., a little before that, a great... Yes? Yes, and that is, you raise a very interesting point, that it is quoted in the Gospel of John before it was written. And therefore, it is believed that there must have been an earlier version which Theodotion revived, because you find Theodotionic quotations in John, but Theodotion as a whole we know came later. So it is usually considered that he must have revised an earlier version. You might say a pre-Theodotion version. Well, the origin between... Yes?
You say Theodotion is literal?
No, Aquila is literal. The first one. Aquila is the literal one. Aquila is also literal. Origin... Between 200 and 250 A.D., this great scholar with tremendous energy set to work to determine what is the correct text of the Septuagint. And so he gathered all the manuscripts he could get hold of. And he prepared a book which he called the Hexapla. Hexapla means six columns. And of these six columns, he put in, for his six columns, he put in for one column the Hebrew text. And for another column, he put a transliteration of the Hebrew text into Greek letters. And then he printed the text of the Septuagint. And then he printed Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion. So he had these six columns. So he called it the Hexapla. And you can see it's a tremendous big book. He spent many years on it. But his text of the Septuagint, he tried to make, the third column, what he thought was the correct text of the Septuagint. And so he compared the manuscripts and put in what he thought was the original, which often, if two manuscripts had different edges, he put them both in. It's a sort of a conflict text often. And then he made notations in it as the differences of the three, of Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion, in his third column. Yes?
Transliteration.
If people didn't know Hebrew, they could still use it. It's like if you use Young's Concordance, you find an Old Testament word in Young's, and if you don't know Hebrew, the Hebrew it gives would mean nothing to you, but Young's writes the Hebrew in English letters. And it's not a particularly good transliteration in Young's, but it enables a person not knowing Hebrew to see that it's the same Hebrew word, or to look the Hebrew word up in the back and see how it's rendered. So that and it's of great value to us today to know how Origen felt the Hebrew was pronounced at that time. But that, of course, wasn't his purpose to help us. Well, the Hexapla, then, has not been preserved, but portions of it have. And portions of it have been discovered in the last century that had been lost. And the Hexapla, most scholars think, resulted in great confusion in the Septuagint, because many of Origen's guesses were copied as part of the Septuagint later on, which were based on his interpretation of the Hebrew or on one of the three. But the Hexapla has been very important in the history of the Septuagint. Well, so much now for C, Greek versions. Now, it's capital D, Aramaic versions. We've already said a bit about Aramaic versions, so I won't much more than mention them now. You would, if you're going to do a great exhaustive Old Testament study, you'll want to use Aramaic versions a great deal. But for most of you, it's better to learn a lot about the Septuagint and little about the Aramaic than to learn a little about both. But the Aramaic versions are, number one, the Targums. I've already mentioned to you, the Targums were the translations made by the Jews for use in the synagogue. Made orally at first, eventually put into writing. And these Targums are quite free. They will often put in an explanation, not merely a translation. There have been some new Targums discovered recently, some new copies of various Targums discovered in the Cairo Geniza. So there's a good deal more being learned about the Targums than was known before. Then that's the Aramaic version. Number one, the Targum. It is one of the four ancient immediate versions. The second Aramaic version of importance is the Syriac. And the Syriac was made of the New Testament first, and then of the Old Testament. The common Syriac is called the Peshitta, made about 400 A.D. There is a man from Mesopotamia, brought up in one of the villages where they still speak an Aramaic dialect, received a training in Alexandria, Virginia, in the Episcopal Seminary there. His name is Lamsa, L-A-M-S-A, and for the last 40 years, he has been publishing what he calls the original Aramaic of the New Testament, and the original Aramaic of the Bible. But what he calls the original of the Bible is the translation made at about 400 A.D. into Aramaic. So you see, it's not near as original as the Greek is, but it's beautifully put out, and I get letters from all over the country asking me if this isn't the original Bible. And I have to refer them to reviews I've written of at different times, pointing out some of its errors. It's unfortunate that a man who is not equipped to be a translator should be able to get such attention to the alleged translations that he issues, which he says are from the original, but actually, as he says, from the Peshitta, which he says is the original Bible, but which all scholars agree was not made until about 400 A.D. But the Peshitta was preceded by the Old Syriac, like the Old Latin. The Old Syriac was earlier translations than the Peshitta into Syriac, and not much of this has been preserved, just a few sections here and there. And then under the Aramaic versions, perhaps we ought also to mention the Hexaplerion. And those of you who remember what I said a few minutes ago about the hexapla will immediately recognize that hexapleric means made from the hexapla. In other words, the hexapleric is not an immediate version. It is a translation into Syriac from Origen's hexapla. And it is useful in reconstructing Origen's hexapla. The hexapleric translations into Syriac go under Aramaic versions. And then capital E is Latin versions. Latin versions. And under Latin versions, we'll mention number one, the earliest, the Itala, I-T-A-L-A. The Itala, also called the Old Latin, translation from the Syriac, which generally agrees with manuscript B. And then number two is the Vulgate. And we have discussed the Vulgate quite a bit in other connections in this course. It is very important. It's an immediate version. It's on the whole a careful translation. We've discussed its relation to the Apocrypha. We've pointed out that it has not been transmitted anywhere near as accurately as have the Greek and the Hebrew. And I don't think, though, the Vulgate gets the attention it should from Protestant scholars, because it is a good translation by Jerome. On the whole, an accurate translation, and is a good help. I think more study should be made of the words in the Vulgate to increase our understanding of them. It does not get as much attention among Protestant scholars as I think it deserves. Among Roman Catholic scholars a few years ago, the Vulgate was the Bible, and the Hebrew and Greek differed from it. They said the Hebrew and Greek have been corrupted. Today, I don't think many Roman Catholic scholars take that attitude anymore towards the Vulgate, because they recognize that it's been poorly transmitted. Now, F, polyglots, P-O-L-Y-G-L-O-T-S, A polyglot is a book which gives several translations together. I received a book recently which has said 26 translations of the New Testament was what they called the book. They are different translations into English by different people of the New Testament. And it is always of value to use a polyglot like that, not as an authority, but as suggesting ideas. You see the difference in different translations, and then you ask yourself, which really is closest to the original? Or is the original somewhere in between them? It is useful, but not determinative. So there is a polyglot published in Germany 100 years ago, which was widely used, and which I thought, when I got a copy of it, I'd made a tremendous advance in my library to get a copy of this polyglot, which had several versions in it. But then I found that the translation of the Greek was simply the Textus Receptus, and the Latin was not an especially good copy of the Latin, and so my copy of this polyglot is laying in the corner of my library, hardly looked at now for 40 years. But the men under whom I studied were constantly using it. I tried to use more accurate editions of the Latin and of the Greek than in that polyglot. Now there have been some new attempts at publishing polyglots, none quite as extensive as that one, but there probably will be more in coming years. Now, conclusion regarding the versions. That was, E was the Latin versions, F was the polyglot, G, conclusion regarding versions of great interest, of great importance for study, but not as accurate on the whole, not as well preserved on the whole as the original Hebrew. And it is far better to learn to understand the original Hebrew well than to have a smattering of knowledge of the versions. If you can get to know the original Hebrew well, and then also get a considerable knowledge of the versions, that is of great value. We continue there then tomorrow for our last hour.